We don't understand that about the WTO in Seattle, especially the one in Quebec. These assholes, they were the ones behind the concrete and the barbed wire. We had them in jail. It was an air-conditioned jail, and they fed pretty good. But we had them behind the troops, you know. We had them boxed in. And in Genoa, it was even worse. We got to understand that about ourselves. We can put these people in jail, you know. That's cool. We have to recognize that power. Now let's make it stick. You know, when they go back to where they live, make their lives unbearable.
From the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, it's time for the Weekly Freak Show. My name's the V-Man, and I'll be your host for this one-hour examination of the news and features not heard in or glanced over by the corporate-controlled media. On this week's program, award-winning journalist Amy Goodman speaks on the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, the fight for free speech radio, and the so-called war on terror. And later, legendary folk singer Utah Phillips joins Freak Radio's C-Line for tea and conversation on the philosophies of anarchism and pacifism. Plus, this week's Spotlight Sound. Stand by for the Weekly Freak Show, coming up next. Amy Goodman is the host of Democracy Now!, the daily syndicated radio program. She is an award-winning journalist who has covered U.S. foreign policy and reported for Pacifica Radio in Mexico, Haiti, and Indonesia. In 1991, along with fellow journalist Alan Nairn, she experienced a massacre of peaceful demonstrators in occupied East Timor. She is a recipient of a 1999 George Polk Award for her work along with Jeremy Scahill on Drilling and Killing, Chevron and Nigeria's Oil Dictatorship. She has earned a reputation for asking hard questions of people in power. Since August, Democracy Now! Has been broadcasting from the studios of Downtown Community Television in exile from Pacifica Station WBAI in New York City after disputes with management there created a hostile working environment. She appeared at San Francisco's Mission High School on December 15th, where she spoke on the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, the fight for free speech radio, and the so-called war on terror.
I was saying earlier at the reception that, you know, having watched East Timor go from a country that is occupied by the Indonesian military, supported by the U.S. government, a very terrible situation, to a country that's about to see its independence on May 30th, a newly born country that... It is this time that is most critical as people get involved in building the democratic institutions of that country and rebuilding a plundered and destroyed nation. Pacifica has not been that extreme, but it is absolutely critical as the democratic institution is set up that we all be a part of it, because that's what democracy looks like. That's what democracy is that we are all a part of that rebuilding. For us in New York, at WBAI, still there are the banned and the fired. We have not been returned to WBAI. Anthony, who is the music maestro and engineer of Democracy Now!, was the arts director of WBAI, and recently, he had left that, but recently he too was banned from the station for broadcasting. Well, one of the programs that Chris Abrams produced from Durban, South Africa, Chris defied Pacifica. They said we couldn't go to the FDAA protests in Quebec. Remember, this is the Democracy Now! That was in Seattle for the Battle of Seattle. The Democracy Now! Was at the Republican and Democratic conventions in the streets. But no, we could not go to these anti-globalization protests in the new Pacifica. Chris went to Quebec anyway, and then she went to Durban, South Africa for the UN Conference Against Racism. And you got to hear here the amazing programs that she set up in the studios of Durban with people like Danny Glover and Jesse Jackson decrying that Pacifica was banning the voices of the Dalits of India, banning the voices of the reparations movement in this country and around the world. Chris made that possible. And when Anthony, though we were exiled from WBAI, went into the station because he still had a program late one night and broadcast Danny Glover Glover and Jesse Jackson decrying the sound barrier that had been imposed even at Pacifica, broadcast Desmond Tutu's speech. He was banned from WBAI to show the direction that Pacifica was going in. They would stop these voices from getting out at all costs. And I also want to thank Miranda Kennedy, who came from Free Speech Radio News and joined us in this most difficult time right after we were thrown out of the station on August 14th, and has remained with us to this time, an anchor of Democracy Now! In Exile. You all have made it possible for this victory, but we have to see it completed with the banned and the fired return, the end of the strike, Democracy Now! Back on the airwaves of Pacifica, and I do believe it's going to happen when the new board takes over, when we work together in restoring democracy to this remarkable network founded more than 50 years ago right here. So it's really wonderful for us all to be able to come right here at the end of this week when this announcement came down, when this victory took place. As we move into this new millennium and this new half century of Pacifica, we can go back to the original mission of Lou Hill, who said there's got to be a media outlet that's not run by corporations that beat the drums for war, but run by journalists and artists. Lou Hill, a man who came out of detention camps after World War II because he refused to fight. He was a pacifist and helped to create, was the founding father of Pacifica as we know it, and made it possible for people like Paul Robeson, who was banned from the airwaves all over this country, not to mention just the public arena in general, except for some black churches and KPFA. That incredible giant could not be heard in this country, but he could here in Berkeley at this small radio station with such an enormous voice. No matter how small the broadcast signal, just the possibility of breaking the sound barrier and what that would mean. People like James Baldwin debating Malcolm X in New York at WBAI around the issue of civil disobedience and the sit-ins. And of course, people like Mumia Abu-Jamal, who has been in prison now for 2 decades, for 20 years. And in February of 1997, we were able to begin the broadcasts of Mumia Abu-Jamal talking about what life was like on death row in this country. We weren't the first to attempt this. Well, National Public Radio the year before broadcast was going to broadcast the commentaries of Mumia Abu-Jamal with the help of Noel Hanrahan, who's here tonight, and a special thank you to Noel and the Prison Radio Project. But going into the prison in Pennsylvania, recording the commentaries of Mumia Abu-Jamal, the NPR editor said they were some of the finest commentaries she had ever heard on NPR. And yet when it came time to run those commentaries, it was the Fraternal Order of Police that prevailed, with a very heavy lobbying campaign leading many to dub NPR as National Police Radio. They pulled those broadcasts before they ever got to air, and they continue to have them locked up in a safe to this day. We attempted Pacifica push to broadcast those tapes, but they've said no. Noel Hanrahan has sued. Mumia Abu-Jamal himself has sued. But they keep them locked up. Maybe cynically, it's because if he's executed, they will have the only tapes of his that have not been aired. And so the next year, working with Noel, we were able to get new tapes of Mumia Abu-Jamal inside the prison, his commentaries broadcasting on Democracy Now!, broadcasting his voice for the first time on a national program day after day. Unfortunately, the day that we began running these commentaries in Pennsylvania, we were broadcasting on 12 stations throughout the state, all run by Temple University. The day we started to air those commentaries, minutes before Democracy Now! Began, we were pulled from the airwaves of Jazz FM, of the radio network WRTI in Pennsylvania. They ended their contract with Pacifica on that day. The head of Temple University said in a letter that it was inappropriate to air the voice of Mumia Abu-Jamal. I think John Edgar Wideman said it best, and certainly we were taught this lesson when he said, if Mumia Abu-Jamal has nothing important to say, why are so many powerful people trying to kill him and shut him up? In fact, in the book that Noel Hanrahan edited of Mumia's commentaries, All Things Censored, he writes about his experience on Democracy Now! In a chapter he calls The Sense of Sensory. That's C-E-N-S-O-R-Y, with a quote, "If censorship reigns, there cannot be sincere flattery, and only small men are afraid of small writings." He begins, "Once again, an institution that claims homage to the holy First Amendment opts for silencing the dissenter rather than allowing freedom of speech, echoing the politically motivated last-minute plug-pulling by NPR's misnamed All Things Considered of a series of commentaries by the writer in 1994, Temple University's Pennsylvania Radio Network, WRTI-FM, and 11 affiliates across the state canceled its subscription to Pacifica Radio Network's Democracy Now! On the day it began airing the latest packet of commentaries making Pennsylvania the alleged cradle of liberty, the citadel of silence and censorship. Democracy Now! Features an opposing view in this age of corporate media and is a popular performer in the Pacifica stable. With a mission of afflicting the comfortable and comforting the afflicted, Democracy Now! Became one of the hottest national daily programs on the air in Pennsylvania until now. Until, that is, it began airing the writer's opinions on America's hellish prisons. Then the powers that be, corporate and political, cut the mic. Silence. In a state that exists to service the mercenary instincts of capital, there can be no true democracy now or ever. Indeed, any true reading of American history reveals a long train of war against democracy. And anything that smells of it is the vast majority of people, Africans, Indians, women, and poor whites, were systematically excluded from power. Democracy Now! Seeks to challenge that hegemony. And when it dares question the prison-industrial complex, we find democracy must yield to the conjunction of politics and capital. Then he quotes Justice Potter Stewart, "Censorship reflects a society's lack of confidence in itself. It is a hallmark of an authoritarian regime." Again, censorship reflects a society's lack of confidence in itself. It is a hallmark of an authoritarian regime. When NPR caved in to cop capital pressure in 1994, it did so after then-Senator Bob Dole challenged their Corporation for Public Broadcasting government subsidies. Even democracy, it seems, has its price. The censor was once an elected official in ancient Rome whose job it was to protect public morals. In this new empire, it damns not just the speaker, but the listener as well, in the name of protecting them. Do you need to be protected from my voice, or do you need protection from your protectors? Mumia Abu-Jamal. We aired the commentaries anyway, though we lost 12 stations. We felt it was absolutely critical to stand up for free speech and academic freedom, since it was a university that ran the airwaves, and freedom of the press. And that it was the mission of journalists to go to where the silence is and say something. That was 1997. Mumia, the following year, actually called into Democracy Now! A number of times, and some of you may remember that. He would just call into the program. He would try it for a month at a time. It would be very difficult. And then occasionally he would call in. When the independentistas, the Puerto Rican independentistas, were being freed from prison, it just so happens that day he was able to get through. We had him on for a minute or two, and then he was cut off. And it was because the prison authorities in Pennsylvania ripped the phone out of the wall when they understood that his voice was being broadcast live for the first time all over the country. He challenged the prison authorities, and ultimately he won his case, and he was able to call in a few more times. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal breaking the sound barrier, and I think it's why part of the pressure built for Democracy Now! To be silenced. That contributed, that was the beginning, when we could see what a difference it made when we weren't just talking about one station or another station, though amazing, like KPFA or WBAI, which were broadcasting Mumia Abu-Jamal's commentaries for a long time before Democracy Now! Came on the scene. But it was when those voices, that ability to broadcast his voice nationally, it was the power of his being heard, his voice being heard nationally, that I think we started to feel the clampdown on Democracy Now!, as well as being able to go then and take it even to a higher level, to the Democratic and Republican convention, and not only broadcast voices like his around the country to a national radio audience, but that's when we started this public media collaboration where we're broadcasting on public access access TV stations on the internet, on shortwave, and on satellite TV, on Dish Network, Free Speech TV's 24-hour channel, 9415. It's at that point, I think, all of these forces together that helped really bring down the final hammer on us at Pacifica, as they were saying at the time that they wanted to broaden audience. In fact, they were doing the very opposite. And you certainly know it here in 1999 when they chained the doors shut of KPFA. But then it was because of you, 10 to 15,000 people marching in the streets, that those chains were broken and the station was reopened. And we want to thank you very much for that, for leading the way for the whole Pacifica Network, for being the prophets of what was to come. That's P-R-O-P-H-E-T-S, the prophets of what the prophets, P-R-O-F-I-T-S, would mean to some of the majority on the board, the possibility of selling the stations. You led the way, and then certainly WBAI understood what it felt like just a year ago, in the Christmas coup, when the Pacifica management came to WBAI, threw out those who were in management at WBAI at a time when we had built our listener base, at a time when we had raised more money than we ever had before, and they changed the locks on the station, threatened any producers who came into the station with police who said that they would arrest us. And, well, this past year, to say the least, has been increasingly difficult as a political purge like we have never seen has taken place at WBAI. The last person to be suspended, it happened, believe it or not, yesterday, when Bob Fass, one of the longest-term producers at WBAI, one of the fathers of freeform radio, went on the air and dared to say on his program that there had been a settlement. This was reported, of course, in New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, San Francisco Chronicle, KPFA. But he dared to say it on WBAI, and he was thrown off the air. So we very much look forward to the new board at Pacifica Radio and that they will turn the tide for us. But of course, it can't just be them. It must be all of us together, ensuring that we have a democratic media, especially in this time of war. How critical it is that we stand up to CMN, Cable Military Network. How critical it is that there be other voices that are heard than those on the networks. I mean, what happened on September 11th was a crime against humanity, and it was a crime that took place on U.S. shores. That's what made it different. In New York, thousands of people died just blocks from where we were broadcasting, incinerated in a minute. Now the numbers beyond 3,000 people. Actually, we will never know how many people died on that day. Now they're counting for history, and it's very important that we come up with that number. But who will not be included? Well, those not counted in life will not be counted in death. The undocumented immigrants who worked at the World Trade Center. Their families, some of them are afraid to come forward because of the increasingly close relationship between the INS and the police, afraid that they could be threatened, the survivors, that they could be deported. And then, of course, there are the corporations, the companies that hired them, some of them for more than a decade at the World Trade Center, don't want to come forward because they don't want to be sanctioned for hiring undocumented workers. So we will really never know the numbers of people who died on that day. But there are a lot of people whose stories we have learned, and we can't hear enough about those stories. Each person, a whole life snuffed out. People like, and you heard her on the program, Rita Lazar, who is the mother of Matthew Lazar, the great historian of Pacifica, who lost her brother, Abe, Matthew's uncle, Abe. He was on the 27th floor. He was with his close friend, Ed, who is a paraplegic. People from the 100th floor made it down. It is another amazing story that more than 90% of the people got out that day. Absolutely incredible. But even as his brother shouted at him, as Rita described it, on his cell phone to Abe, please leave, you can go now, he wouldn't leave his best friend Ed waiting for emergency workers to come and save him. And that never happened. Rita Lazar wrote a letter to the New York Times, and it actually was printed. It said, not in my name, not in my brother's name. She tells the story of her brother, but she also has a second part of that story, which is what should be done. You have Orlando and Phyllis Rodriguez, whose son, Greg Ernesto, died above the 100th floor, worked at Cantor Fitzgerald. They too wrote a letter. It didn't get published in the newspaper, but it did swirl around the internet. And they said, we are grieving. We have lost our son, but we don't want someone in Afghanistan to go through the same thing. Not in our name, not in our son's name. And then there was Judy Kane, whose husband was a Marine, a Vietnam veteran who worked at the World Trade Center. He died as well. And she said, not in my name, not in my husband's name. All of these people tell the stories of their loved ones that they lost. And we see them on television, and that's very important because terror must be routed out all over the world. But when they get to the second part, what they think the solution should be, which is not to kill innocent civilians, to avenge the killing of innocent civilians. Then the television networks cut away from what they have to say, and they turn to the, quote, experts on terrorism, like Henry Kissinger, or Oliver North, or Larry Wayne Harris. Now, who are these people? Henry Kissinger, we know. Maybe the corporate networks have got it right. It takes one to know one. Henry Kissinger, who September 11th is a very significant day, right? In 1973, the day that Salvador Allende died as Pinochet rose to power, supported by Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger. And we just passed the 10th anniversary of the Santa Cruz massacre in Timor, November 12th, 1991, it took place, where the Indonesian military with U.S. weapons killed more than 270 Timorese, one of the smaller massacres there, as the Indonesian military, trained, armed, financed by the United States, killed a third of the population in Timor. How did it all start in 1975? Well, the day before the invasion, Henry Kissinger and President Gerald Ford met with Suharto, the dictator of Indonesia, and gave the go-ahead for that invasion. Only in the last week has the final smoking gun come out, the cable, the document that showed that Kissinger and Ford gave the green light for that invasion. That's 200,000 people. In Chile, it's thousands of people. Vietnam and Cambodia, we're talking 2 million. What is the definition of terrorism but the killing of innocent civilians? We have to have a single standard of terror. And of course, Oliver North, we know his support of the Contras, the undermining of congressional rules, banning support of the Contras, led to the killing of thousands of Nicaraguans with the U.S. support of the Contra thugs in Nicaragua. And then Larry Wayne Harris, a man who you might not know who he is. I saw him on CNN, and it said bioterrorism expert. And he was talking about, you know, how easy it is to get germ warfare, to be able to get your hands on it. I remembered something odd about this person, and then Chris, the producer, did some LexisNexis searches, and she came up with, just a few years ago, wasn't he the guy who was arrested with another member of the white Aryan nations for getting bubonic plague in the mail and also being involved with an anthrax case? He wasn't identified as a member of the Aryan nations who had gotten bubonic plague in the mail. He was identified as a bioterrorism expert. Well, we have to let people hear different voices around the country and around the world, like Faridi Saq, who, when asked if he would still speak up against the bombing of Afghanistan and what effect it would have. Well, you heard what he had to say. He was an ANC fighter. He had trained in the madrasas of Pakistan, then headed for the last 4 years the Gender Equity Commission of South Africa in post-apartheid South Africa, wrote the book on being a Muslim. And he said, you know, we didn't think necessarily that we would be able to overthrow apartheid, but we had no choice. It was our integrity at stake. We just knew that we had to fight. And I think that is a very important lesson for today. What alternative do we have? In Timor in 1991, having survived that massacre, along with Alan Nairn, another journalist who has done remarkable work all over the world in exposing terror, when we walked on that day 10 years ago with the Timorese who ultimately were massacred, at the end, when we were brought to the hospital as the lucky ones, we had survived. and they had not. The doctors and nurses started to cry when they saw us. Alan was covered in blood. And I think there's a real lesson there as we analyze the media today. I think they cried because they saw a symbol of America, those that they saw could protect them, bloodied. They saw their shield bloodied, and they felt like they had no hope. We represent two things all over the world. We represent the shield, the American people, and the sword, the U.S. government, because we provide weapons all over the world. What happened on September 11th, with thousands of people dying in this country, unfortunately, is all too familiar to people around the world, in Argentina, in Guatemala, in El Salvador, Vietnam, Timor, in Chile. But in those cases, it is because of the U.S. government supporting terror regimes in those countries. And now it's come to our soil. I think there's no question that Osama bin Laden should be tried, that the evidence should be gathered, and he and his allies should be brought before an international criminal court, and he should be tried. The problem is the U.S. has fought the setting up of an international criminal court. The Pentagon first was fighting it covertly, and then they were more explicit about it. Why? Because they're concerned that U.S. officials would be dragged before that court as well. People like Henry Kissinger, people like President Bush the first and the second. We have to have a uniform standard so that you don't have the thousands of people that we've seen in New York carrying those color Xeroxes of their loved ones that are posted, were posted everywhere, that said, "Have you seen?" And they would have a name, "Last seen on the 100th floor of the World Trade Center. If you see him, please call his mother." And also so that we don't see those pictures carried by the mothers and the grandmothers of the missing in Argentina. "Have you seen my daughter? Have you seen my grandson?" What happened on September 11th has happened everywhere and must be stopped, has happened in many places, I should say, and must be stopped. And we, in the most powerful country on earth, have to make a decision and then act on that every day of our lives, whether we want to represent the sword or the shield. Thanks very much.
I turned on my radio, spun the dial, thought I'd listen to some news for a while. I grabbed the knob, spun it around, got NPR. Here's what I found. Real news? Hardly a trace, just one damn marathon marketplace. The Nasdaq's up, the Dow's in the cellar, and NPR sold out to Rockefeller. Hostile takeover. Real hostile. Well, I hear about all the antitrust and all the day traders who bit the dust. Mergers, buyouts, and acquisitions. Low-down crooks in high positions. Wheelers, dealers, and CEOs fired and paid off through the nose. Buying yachts and fancy homes with the bailout money from the savings and loans. And I get pissed off, that is. It's dot-com this and dot-com that. The underwriters are getting fat on airwaves stole from you and me by a bunch of thieves called the FCC. They don't give a damn what we want and need. They've all caved into corporate greed and sold us out to the ruling class. Well, the whole damn bunch can hiss my dot-com. This is a family show, folks. FCC says, watch your language. English. What's yours? I got tired of being treated like a veg, so I called up the station and canceled my pledge. In a mighty act of liberation, sent the money off to my community station. I said, I love you, but if you blow it, I'll sure as hell let you know it. I'll knock the radio off the shelf, buy a transmitter, and do it myself. Whitebeard the Pirate. This is radio station HOBO, broadcasting on a vagrancy of 60 to 90 days, signing off for now.
From the studios of Freak Radio, 96.3 FM, in Santa Cruz, California. You're tuned to the Weekly Freak Show on Berkeley Liberation Radio, 104.1 FM in Berkeley, California. Please have a pen and paper ready to take down our contact information at the end of this one-hour broadcast. That was Utah Phillips with this week's Spotlight Sound, NPR Talkin' Blues, from the compilation CD Sing We Sing, available at iuma.com. Utah Phillips is a nationally known folk singer, storyteller, Grammy Award nominee, and host of the nationally syndicated radio show Loafer's Glory, Hobo Jungles of the Mind. For more than 30 years, he has been traveling throughout the U.S. and Canada, singing songs and telling stories, harvesting an abundance of tales, songs, and poems from his experiences and the lives of the people he's encountered on the road or riding the rails. Freak Radio's C-Line had the opportunity to chat with the legendary performer on October 19th while he was in Santa Cruz for a performance with Rosalie Sorrells. They were joined by Craig Metz as they shared tea and conversation in a friend's squat in the forest. Utah discusses his views on the attacks of 9/11, the bombing of Afghanistan, and the philosophies of anarchism and pacifism. He begins by commenting on a quote from September 11th published on his website, which reads, "If you love peace, first you have to find it in your own soul, and then learn to live it where you are."
Peace isn't just when shooting stops or laying down guns or knives, but dealing with your anger, dealing with your rage every day in every situation. And these terrible events have unlocked a tremendous amount of rage by the people who did it and the people who suffered from it. And now, of course, we're bombing the tar out of people who are already in the Stone Age. You know, patently absurd. You have this monolith of military-industrial complex. You have a capitalist government, a government that's been taken over by major capitalists. The objective, of course, is the globalization of capital, and it's damn well going to be Eurocentric. You know, it's going to be European-dominated. The first wave of imperialism was, in order to have access to the resources and to a pacified workforce and a consumer base, is by physically occupying, like the British in India or the Dutch in the East Indies. It's really expensive. And it costs a lot of lives, which, of course, the British squandered during the First and Second World War. The empire fell apart. The second wave of imperialism is happening, and that is, hey, we don't have to occupy the territory. We just have to own the banking, the financial system. Hence WTO, hence NAFTA, World Bank, IMF. All of that is a Eurocentric imperialism to consolidate its control of global capital. That's the objective. Now, domestically, what do we have? Considering that the war is a manifestation of that, what do we have that can interpose itself between that objective and the forces that are trying to pull it off, Bush and all of his cronies and all that? Well, what major forces are there in the society? You've got the three branches of the government, executive, legislative, judicial. You've got mass media. You've got foreign opposition, foreign pressure. And you've got public opposition, i.e. peace movement. None of those have interposed themselves between the perpetrator and the supposed result, the goal, except the peace movement. The net effect of which has been zero. As a matter of fact, it has. We're practicing the politics of futility. We're practicing tactics that we inherited from the civil rights movement in the late 50s and early 60s that were mandatory in a militant armed South of nonviolence, the teach-in, the vigil, mass demonstration, civil disobedience. And we carried those tactics into the Vietnam War, that whole movement, you know. We emerged from that with those tactics and were so predictable that along came the Gulf War and it was like we weren't even there because everything we did was so damn predictable. Now, we got to have a change in tactics. We have to interpose something larger, something different between these assholes and the goal, you know, the object of globalizing capitalism. Well, okay, so the discussion has to start taking place about how do we escalate the tactics? You know, what do you do to escalate the tactics? To me, escalating the tactics are organized tax refusal, war tax resistance. We need workshops all over the country about how to start alternative funds so that you funnel your tax money into local and community projects and into proactive businesses. We need task forces and meetings on intervening in the curricular process in the public schools. In Florida, during the Gulf War, the Army was actively recruiting in the public schools, the high schools. The state Supreme Court, with a lawsuit, said that there are going to be military recruiters in the high schools. Since they are public institutions, it's okay to have peace recruiters. Why aren't we doing this? Why aren't we getting in with the PTA like Operation Push does, like, you know, the religious fundamentalists? Why aren't we dealing with the PTA and making sure that there's other information available to students, you know, other ways to look at things? That's a lot of hard work. And then I also think women understand the real consequences of war better than most men do. And I think that the core of a militant peace movement that's large enough to interpose itself, the core of that is going to be women. Going to have to be women. Women understand that the similarity, the basic similarity between, say, First World War, Second World War, Vietnam, Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge, Bosnia, Serbia, Croatia, all of this. Women aren't doing it, kids aren't doing it, old people aren't doing it, disabled people aren't doing it. It's young men with guns that are hammering everybody else. So we don't have a problem with violence in the world. We've got a serious male problem, and we're just not dealing with it in those terms. And the only people who can really tell us how to deal with it, who can define the behavior for us, are women organized to do just that. So those are the main three things that I would throw into the hopper of any discussion about where to escalate the tactics.
Do you think any of your knowledge on labor history and direct action could add to social movements that are happening right now, or do you think that those tactics aren't really what we need?
The labor movement is still a major social movement. The only thing that's standing between us and going back to an industrial dark age, the labor movement, not the politicians that gave us Social Security, workman's compensation, federal aid to schools, on and on, you know, organized people working and struggling and sometimes getting killed to make sure that we had those 8-hour day. The labor movement gave us the weekend, just like the AFL said, far out. It doesn't stop here, you know, it doesn't stop here. And the labor movement had to be a direct action movement. There wasn't any sense, you know, in the old wobbly days working in the forest. If the conditions were lousy, there was no safety, there was no food, there was no heat, there was no showers, treated like animals, to write your congressman or senator, because they got to be a congressman or senator by owning the forest or the mines. That hasn't changed very much, has it? So the only thing left to you was direct action at the point of production. That's where the labor movement has to go. They have to acknowledge their roots. As has happened in Canada, believe me, I belong to the Canadian Auto Workers and Mine Mill and Smelter 598 in Sudbury, Ontario. And here's what happened. The entrenched power structure realized that the labor movement had tremendous power. Coming out of the Great Depression, able to achieve these, you know, monumental victories, had a lot of power in the workplace. They said, okay, we know you have power, know how to use it, so we're going to give you access to our process. Set up your political action committees. Elect your representatives to the Senate and to Congress, and they will achieve legislatively what you would normally do over a bargaining table. That was a carrot on a stick. It led the best organizing effort out of direct action from the shop floor, from the workplace, into the halls of Congress, and failed again and again, resulting in a lot of repressive labor legislation. The labor movement has got to bail on that and go back into the workplace and organize there. I was born in a hospital that was built and owned by the United Auto Workers. The idea of there being federal health care or socialized health care was never an issue. It was a bargaining issue on the table, and there was enough strength to build a hospital. That's what we got to get back to, and get wage workers out from front of their television sets and get into the union meetings, learning to grievance procedures, like learning first how to grieve on their shop stewards and their union bureaucrats, and rebuild the unions democratically from the bottom up. First part, direct action in the labor movement to begin to control the tools of production, the means of production and distribution. What do we used to say? Create abundance for workers and nothing for parasites. Then, of course, organizing industrially is the next big thing. I remember walking a picket line at Eastern Airlines in Portland. I had gotten off of an airplane, and there was a picket line. Of course, I was walking the other way, so I wasn't crossing the picket line except to get to the parking lot. But I stopped and marched with them. While we were walking around in a circle, I said, now, you haven't had a contract, you know, with this airline, the Eastern, for, what, 2 years? Right. So you're marching out here, and you're on strike. The machinists are still working on the airplanes. The baggage handlers are still handling the baggage. The pilots are still flying, you know. Also, there are people who belong to your union flight attendants who are going to work for United. Well, you see them walking the door up at American, and say, how do you feel about that? It's called union scabbing. Wouldn't it be wonderful if everybody who worked for the airline, every wage worker on the airline belonged to one airline industrial union, where an injury to one was an injury to all? Then your bargaining potential would be enormous, and you might even wind up owning an airline if you wanted to do that. It's the same in the shed down here, you know? The faculty are wage workers. The working class is people who work for wages and have a boss, period. If all you're selling is your labor energy and nothing else, you don't own the means of production, you don't own the tools you work with, college professor to ditch digger, you're in the working class. The kind of consciousness that needs to happen in faculty who are being driven to the wall is to find a bargaining agent on campus, like the janitorial, like the labor's union, who will accept jurisdiction and join it, see, and build one union of educational workers. And you win. You know, it's obvious, you'll win. Of course, that's why when industrial unionism raised its ugly head, first with the IWW, then with the CIO, which are built on the same plan, capitalism said, okay, we'll do business with the AFL, and then we'll use the AFL to break up the IWW, certainly use the AFL to red bait communists or radicals out of the CIO and then take it over. That's the devil's crossroad that they walk to, you know. But it's still union brothers and sisters. You've got to pull them back in. They have to realize where their interest lies and that an injury to one is an injury to all.
Could you speak to your experience as a soldier in the Korean War and how that could add to dialogue about the war on terrorism?
People should be talking to soldiers more, and soldiers should be talking more, especially to their kids, about the experience of war. I mean, I saw a little third world country that had been occupied for many, many years being obliterated, being torn to pieces by the impact of a Western army, enormous amounts of arms, a lot of firepower, and then the cultural imperialism that was destroying its institutional structure. It was a Confucian society with all of its limitations, you like, a limited role for women. But when I was in Korea, so many of the women were prostitutes because their fathers had been killed, and it was only the women left to try to put the brothers and sisters through school. When we got there, Korea was 90% literate, higher literacy rate than the United States. It was very essential. And those kids go to school would come out trilingual. You know, some European language, generally English, Korean, and Chinese. Japanese, when the Japanese were there, were quadrilingual. So the only way they could make money in a culture that had never provided any role for women was by becoming prostitutes, especially catering to the GIs, you know, the soldiers. Yeah, sure, there are mortar shells falling and I'm getting shot at, but the most moving experiences were dealing with the Koreans themselves, really very proud, very bright people just being bullied and destroyed. I remember Ginger. See, I was married when I went to Korea, and I didn't fool around. I was just was not built that way. But everybody else, you know, when we were down back to the rear to the ordnance units, we were living in these Quonset huts that were fueled by kerosene, and the lines would freeze in the winter. And those are the coldest winters you can imagine. I mean, we were losing more people to trench foot than we were to gunshot. And so the guys would go into the villages, into the hooches, and take up steady time with one of the prostitutes. And then, like, if it was PFC Brown, then the Joseon became Mrs. Brown, so there was no confusion. You know, there was no, you know, it was like a family. And, of course, the Joseons would always save money, sort of at the end of the month before the next pay period when you were broke, they'd always have money to hand back. It was a system that worked okay, you know. But then Roger Aziz, a hooch commander, He fell in love with Ginger, which was the Joseon he was staying with. Another thing about the village was, see, the Koreans had invented central heating. They had a little clay stove outside at one corner of the building and then trenches underneath the floor. And the trenches would get sometimes so hot you couldn't sit on them. So it was warm. And he fell in love with Ginger, and he wanted to bring her back to the States. And he'd go to the day room. There was always a few old magazines there, and she would sit and pore over these pictures of the Manhattan skyline. And I was an ombudsman. You know, sometimes GIs get drunk and start beating on somebody, or families would come from the southern part of South Korea and try to take the girls back, and there'd be a row in the village. Sometimes, if it heated up the air up in the divisions, you know, where the shooting was going on, they called them short-time girls, would be driven back. And they'd entered the rear areas where, like I say, this population was stable. And, in fact, unionized prostitutes in those divisionary areas were unionized into what was called the Rose Club. And then they would start hammering on the short-time girls who were coming in, you know, because basically that's when the VD rate went up. This is a whole world I've never talked about, you know. This is the first, folks. And it was a whole language, a whole pidgin English. A whole polyglot of English, Korean, and Japanese. Interesting, the Japanese tried to just get rid of the Korean language. It couldn't be taught in the schools or anything like that. So the Koreans, when they finally were liberated from the Japanese, were extremely proud of their language, and they didn't want to hear it coming out of foreigners' mouths, anybody's. So when I'd asked Yoon Suk Han, a Korean attached to our unit, to teach me Korean, he taught me Japanese. So I came home thinking I was speaking Korean. I wasn't. I was speaking air-ass Japanese. So Ginger, Roger wanted to marry Ginger, and I was supposed to broker this, you know. He wanted me to really talk to her about that. And I went to her. I remember it was such a cold, cold, cold day. She sold chestnuts, a little clay hibachi with a metal thing with a crank on it that blew air into the coals, and then chestnuts on the top that would pop open. Blinding snow. She's there with this at the corner of a building, totally deserted wasteland, you know, under a blanket huddled over the hibachi, you know, waiting to sell chestnuts to anybody who came by. So I sat with her, and I said, you know, Roger really wants to, broken, whatever, Hugo stateside Roger. And she said that she thought about it. She said, one time, Migo stateside, one time Roger say, do this, I know can do, he laugh. He say again, do this, no can do, he maybe shake his head. Next time, say, do this, I know can do, he get mad. So I stay here. She understood that she couldn't go into that culture from where she was coming from without making his life very difficult. So she would rather stay there sitting in the snow selling chestnuts. Wow. That was brave. That was really brave.
What about pacifism? You're a pacifist, or you identify as a pacifist. What can you tell the people who want to move in this world as a pacifist and challenge the powers?
Nonviolence. The man can escalate from a cop with a handgun up to a hydrogen bomb and everything in between. And he's always going to say to you, I own this game. Come on up that road with me. You know, he's saying to the Black Panthers, come on up that road with me. He's saying to the young lords in Chicago, come up that road with me. How far do you want to come up that road? And then he kills you. You got to take a road he doesn't own. Got to take a road that he doesn't understand, you know. Doesn't understand nonviolence. Right? If you take the road that he already owns, you're going to get killed. So we're saying that pacifism is not a tactic. It's a practical necessity. We've learned this in the Redwoods, right? And Judy Berry, she understood that very well, that it's not a tactic. It's not something you use here and then not then. It's a way of life. It's a practical necessity. Getting there means dealing, coming to grips with your own anger, with your own capacity for anger, your own capacity for rage, your own capacity for violence, and then dealing with it like alcoholism in the same way, you know, exactly the same way, which is to say every minute of every day for your whole life, because the anger doesn't go away like alcoholism doesn't go away, even though you'd been dry for years. Ammon Hennessy, who taught me about pacifism, said, you know, your anger's not going to go away, so you cherish it. But you use it as an engine to get you going up this other road. You use it as an engine to get things done.
How do you think, or do you have some advice on how pacifism can challenge state powers, state terrorism?
Of course. Lawrence, Massachusetts, 1912, the Bread and Roses strike. Joe Ator stood on the stoop in front of the Austin Mill, a mile around the base, and he said, fellow workers, the workers with their hands in their pockets have more power than the combined power of the bosses, besides which the bosses can't put their hands there. That's a pacifist thing to say, that everybody who's working here, put your hands in your pockets. The light stops, the food stops, the sewage doesn't go away when you flush the handle, the water doesn't come out of the tap. The rich starve and freeze alone in the dark. Who really has the power here? Who really has the power? When we acknowledge that power, that we all have that power, and that we have that power collectively, and that power is basically put your hands in your pockets and make everything stop. The movement I want to see is built on that principle, but massively. Like I told Judy once, I said, the earth is not dying, it's being killed. And the people who are killing it have names and addresses. Let's use power structure research to find out who's really making the decisions, who's really got their foot on your neck. And then organize nonviolently, so massively, that you go and sit in their driveway, on their porch, lie down in front of their car when they go to a restaurant or go to the theater. They simply put them in prison, make it impossible for them to move. And when you're hauled away, you're hauled away. And other people, thousands, millions of people take your place. See, Indira gets hauled away. Fill the jails. If there's violence, it comes from them, but then it always did. Okay? And just stop everything. Just stop. Prevent them from enjoying their wealth. Prevent them from enjoying their ill-gotten gain until they decide to make a different kinds of decisions. I call it put them in jail. We don't understand that about the WTO in Seattle, especially the one in Quebec. These assholes, they were the ones behind the concrete and the barbed wire. We had them in jail. It was an air-conditioned jail, and they fed pretty good, but we had them behind the troops, you know. We had them boxed in. And in general, it was even worse. We got to understand that about ourselves. We can put these people in jail, you know. That's cool. We have to recognize that power. Now let's make it stick. You know, when they go back to where they live, make their lives unbearable. It sounds simple, but it's got to be millions of people who understand that power and are willing to act together to prevent the people who have their foot on their neck, on our neck, from making decisions to destroy us. The old anarchist phrase from France years ago is destroy that which destroys you, but not using their tools. Like I said, if you use their tools to do it, they're gonna kill you. The people who flew those airplanes in those buildings destroyed a lot of people who are simply innocent. Secretaries, janitors, third world people working behind lunch counters, you know. There's no moral equivalence. You can't say, well, we hurt you year after year so badly that puts so much moral currency in your bank account that you can spend against us to get even. There's no moral equivalence. We're both wrong. Mm-hmm. We're both wrong. See? We're both stupidly wrong. We have to identify what happened to those buildings and name it for what it is. Fundamentalist violence. It's the same thing that happens in front of women's clinics. See? It's the same class of act. Religious fundamentalist violence. And they're both wrong. That opens up a lot of other options, you know. There can't be a peace movement, there can't be a nonviolent movement that posits a moral equivalence, which is just a cycle of revenge then. We hurt you, so you're going to hurt us, and then we're going to hurt you back, and you're going to hurt us, until it escalates where? To a nuclear war? What stops that? You know, what's going to stop that? That's what the major concern, you know. How do we end the cycle of reprisal? It's happening in Israel, isn't it, and in Palestine.
Right now it feels like the left and right, you know, they're united in the idea that we got to get them, right? The left, you know, wants to do it through the international courts and the UN, and the right wants to do it through bombings and military action.
Yep.
And from my point of view, the people really responsible for this action, I feel like, is the U.S. government, that it's a logical thing that people are going to fight back, that instead the left should say that it's okay what happened, but we should put our energies into trying to change the U.S. government.
We do. We have been, you know, as we've been doing with the mass demonstration of WTO, and also the grassroots organizations that you don't hear much about, but are working day and night, people like Global Exchange. But one of the things I want to see, is there's a lot of voices I'm not hearing. In NPR, I'm hearing the voices of the generals and Rumsfeld and all that. The voices I'm not hearing are the people who experienced the problem. There's a lot of hatred there. Our people in your town, have got to be in direct touch with the people who experienced the hatred, because they're the only ones who can define it. Stop making pronouncements. We've got to stop making mandates. We've got to being Americans left or right and saying, we know what we're talking about, you know, and shut up and listen. And that's a good use for the Internet now. Is to get in touch with people who experience that hatred and say, explain it to us. What is it that you really hate? What is it you really hate here? And ask honest questions about that, because that's the only way you're going to be able to modify behavior, is by listening to the answers and then changing your behavior according to the answers. That's a major step. You know, fortunately, the Internet can be used to do that. It's probably one of the only uses I know of for it. But I want to hear the voices that I'm not hearing. I'm hearing a lot of pronouncements left and right, but I'm not hearing the voices of the people that really experience the imperialism, really experience the foot on the neck, and who really live the hatred. I want them to be able to say to me directly where the hate is coming from. It might be that we're not even defining this thing, but then we're Americans. We define everything, you know, according to our best interest, you know, whether we're left or right as far as that goes, you know. No, you got to shut up and listen.
I think you bring a lot of wisdom into our communities and a lot of inspiration. And I'm wondering what you draw on, what keeps you, you know, with the struggle and keeping going.
Peter Murin, who founded the Catholic Worker years and years ago, this Houses of Hospitality and the Skids all over the country now, he said, I want to live in a world where it's easier to be good. Boy, when you're cold and hungry and lonely, it's hard to be good, you know. It's hard. And when you've got a lot of anger and you've got a lot of bitterness and your energy is going, you're flying out of you, you know, with no tangible results, that makes it easier for you to be good. To be what you were born with. We were all born good. There's no original sin. The anarchist notion is we were all born good. It's just that something we abandon or are forced to abandon to authorities and institutions over which we have no control. When we're abandoned to the public school system, you see, with its own agendas, we're like little milk bottles that are empty and all this shit gets poured in it. And you know, becoming an anarchist is taking the bottle and turning it over and dumping all that out and then putting stuff back in that makes sense. And part of that is I was born good and I want to be happy and I'm linked with other lives, so I want to help other people to be happy in a world where it's just easier to be good. That's the motor, you know, that's the engine. The other part is, I guess, a kind of a sense of mission, you might call it. Eamon Hennessy said, anarchy isn't a noun, it's an adjective that describes a tension between moral autonomy and political authority, especially in the area of combinations, if they're going to be voluntary or coercive. Most of the combinations we grow up in, you know, in that milk bottle, are highly coercive. Boss, employee, teacher, student, parental, marital. These are culturally compelled. We're not the architects of these compulsions. We inherit them. They're imposed upon us. Well, all we ever wanted to do was to, among ourselves, create voluntary combinations of which we are the architects and which serve our needs as we define them and not as they are defined for us. When I remember talking to a bunch of young people there at College of the Atlantic in Maine. They invited me to do a commencement speech. I said, you know, you're going to go out there and do a bunch of dumb jobs. You're going to go out there and be wage workers. You're going to do, you know, this work and that kind of work for a paycheck and have a boss. One of your jobs is going to be to find out what your work is. Separate from toil. Work's something you do for yourself. Toil is something you do for other people. You're going to figure out what your real work is, what animates you, what satisfies your soul. And then you're going to do those dumb jobs, but you're going to take part of the money and part of the time and use it to acquire the skills and the tools to do your work. And when you've got that, you're going to call up the boss, and you're going to call in well. And then you're going to do your work. If it's something you can't do by yourself, you're going to find other people who are like that and form that voluntary combination and get the work done. Ammon said to me, we were working there in the Joe Hill House, the house for transients, migrants, one of the houses of hospitality out by the railroad yard in Salt Lake. He said, look, if you will agree to four things that I agree to, if we can agree between ourselves, we will do our share of the work of our world, which is right here at the Joe Hill House, that we will care for the afflicted, that we will only take what we need and put back what we can, and that we will not hurt anybody. All the things you can't get from the boss, you can't get from the state. But if you'll agree to it, I'll agree to it, we can start to make that voluntary combination and begin to get the work of the world done without the boss and without the state. That's what I carry with me into the world. See, to talk about, not to polemicize from the stage particularly, that's the way that I get someplace, but to sit like this and talk, that's a certain amount of mission that keeps me moving.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening. The Weekly Freak Show is produced live in the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, and can also be heard on Micropower 102.9 FM in Dade City, Florida. The interviews featured in this program are only a sample of the fine shows each week on Freak Radio. To hear it all, 24 hours a day, listen online at www.microradio.net/FRSC. That's www.microradio.net/FRSC. For questions and comments, send email to frsc@microradio.net. That's frsc@microradio.net. Or snail mail to P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California 95061. That's P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California, 95061, or call us, area code 831-427-4523. That's 831-427-4523. Thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project for distribution. Our theme music was arranged and performed by Neil Norman and his Cosmic Orchestra. For C-Line and everyone here at Freak Radio, my name's the V-Man, and that's a wrap.